Okay, thank you very much, and thank you to CIFA for the opportunity to participate today. What CIFA is all about is policy relevant research and using research to bring evidence and good theory to bear on policy questions. And I think what we've heard today is a series of papers that all do exactly that. And they do it well. That's my overall impression of the day. Sitting out the front here, we have a number of people that are involved in regulation, and I take it that what you want from us is some policy perspective and context as to are these papers asking the right questions and are they taking the most important things into account in the way that they answer those questions. So I want to try and steer my comments towards that particular focus. We've got six papers. They do quite different things, obviously, but broadly speaking, I think of them as falling into two groups. There's one group of papers that's about banking and about the risks associated with banking and risk management practices and so on, and the policies around that. So there are three papers that fall into that category, and then there were another three that are about either superannuation or asset management and the various policy challenges that arise from that. So let me talk about banking first of all. And I think the first thing to say here is that obviously we've had a crisis. We've learnt that globally crises are extremely costly, and we need to have well-designed policies that appropriately manage the risk of future crises happening again. In order to have sensible debate about how those policies are going to be structured, it's important to have good information about actual risk management practices that are in place at the moment. And two of the papers, I think, provide some very good information about that. Elizabeth Sheedy's paper about risk management practices, I think when that work is completed, that's going to provide a very useful information base about risk management practices and cultures in financial institutions, which I think will then be very helpful to policymakers. I won't comment in detail on that, but I think that's very useful work. Similarly, the paper presented by James Cummings, which is which was the one about provisioning practices, that to me provided the reassuring and helpful information that the provisioning practices of banks at the moment under APRA supervision are having the intended effect of making provisioning practices responsive to forward-looking risks on banks' balance sheets. So that's all good and useful work. I won't comment on that in more detail, but of the three banking papers, the one that I was most interested in was the one by Stephen King, which was the one on crisis risk and policies associated with that. One of the hazards, I think, of providing comments on this sort of research is that you're always going to get the comment that there are more things that you could have taken into account, and that's not always helpful because you can't get everything into a model, and it's your job to narrow it down to a question that you can answer with the tools available. Having said that, I think there are some more things that need to be taken into account, at least when you think about the application of this work to policy conclusions. When I think about what causes crises in banking, liquidity is one of those. If a bank suffers a liquidity panic, then that can drive it into crisis. Another thing that can cause crisis, and arguably more important, is asset quality. If banks have just got bad assets or assets that go bad during the life of those assets, you've got a problem. Those two things can be interrelated because fears about asset quality can generate a liquidity panic on a bank, or uncertainties about asset quality can generate the same effect. Another cause of crisis can be currency mismatch. That's what the that was a very big part of the Asia crisis 15 years ago, and it doesn't really quite fit neatly into either of those categories. But it's an asset liability mismatch. The thing that I really want to focus on here is that there's a, when we talk about liquidity crises, which is what Stephen's focusing on, there's an element to liquidity crises that can be self-fulfilling. If you think about Stephen's model, if the cost of funds goes up enough because the lenders to banks are sufficiently worried about banks' capacity to repay, then you've got a crisis and banks can't repay at the higher funding rate. But there is a component of the literature which recognises that that dynamic can generate self-fulfilling crises, such that if people expect there to be a crisis, there will be one, because if everybody wants their money back at once, banks are unable to provide it. Now, arguably, that kind of dynamic was a big part of the GFC, and a big part of the defence mechanism against that was the central bank lender of last resort facility. Now, this some people would describe as a bailout, but it doesn't quite fit into the category of a bailout as Stephen was conceiving it, which I think is more, you described it as free money, which the lender of last resort, I think, doesn't quite come under that heading, because you're lending and you're getting your money back, you're getting appropriate collateral, and that can be a low-risk operation for central banks, particularly if it defuses the self-fulfilling aspect of the crisis. I think part of what we're seeing in Europe at the moment in the last couple of years is that since the ECB has taken a more front-footed approach to promising liquidity support, that has helped to diffuse the self-fulfilling liquidity crisis dynamic. So I'd like to see some of that recognised, at least in the... it's probably hard to get it into the model, but at least into the discussion around the policy relevance of the conclusions. I'll just turn quickly to the second set of papers, because I know we're short of time, but the second set of issues was to do with superannuation and funds management and all the policy questions that arise from that. I think the general background to all of this is a shared assumption that the quantum of saving going into the retirement saving pool is suboptimal and that it's inefficiently managed for various reasons. I think both of those assumptions were built into the financial system inquiry this week, and they underlie these papers today. The question is, if those assumptions are correct, what is causing those things to happen? And I think the papers that we've seen today give us some useful perspective on all of that. Jeff's paper, I think, asks the useful preliminary question, what would an optimal portfolio look like? And that then provides a basis for asking, why haven't we got that? I think it was Samuelson who was once asked, is there anything in economics that is, any theoretical proposition in economics that is both true and not obvious? And his answer was, yes, the theory of comparative advantage. I found Jeff's paper useful because it provided me with some things that look like they're valid conclusions that weren't obvious to me. The displaced V-shape as a optimal retirement strategy, I thought that was a good insight. The idea of the fulcrum returns structure and the things that were said about incentives, I think, were useful insights that I think can feed into the policy process. Policymakers need to think about what are the obstacles to getting towards the optimum, if that is indeed the optimum that we've just heard about. The other two papers, the ones by Ian Ramsey and Andrew Godwin, I think also provided some good context on all of this. They focused more on the questions of knowledge and disclosure. There was some very interesting factual information presented on the state of knowledge about superannuation and so on from Ian Ramsey's paper. It occurred to me here that if economists believe anything, they believe in optimization by individuals when it comes to decision making. And if individuals are really as ignorant as all of this, I think it raises the question, why aren't they going to the effort of trying to get more information so that they can make better decisions? Now, one possible answer to that is, and the related question, what do you do about it? One possible answer is you need some regulation to make the information flows better so that people will be better educated. But I think there's a preliminary question, which is, why aren't people going to the effort in the first place? What is it about the incentives that make it not worth their while to do it? This partly relates back to Jeff's question as well, because I think one of the things that Jeff didn't talk about as much as he could have is the role of the public sector pension as a kind of a backstop which underlies all of this. Now, it may be the case that the interaction between the pension and the tax system and the various other factors means that it's really not worthwhile for a lot of individuals to invest a lot of effort into understanding the fine details of the system, because they trust that they'll get the pension, they're getting their superannuation guarantee, and the value that they can add by putting in the extra effort to find out more about the system might not be worth the effort. So to me, it would be a useful additional phase, say for Alan Ramsey, for Ian Ramsey's project, and maybe for Jeff as well, to think about the cost benefit that is facing consumers as they need to think about how to invest in doing all that. So I think I'm probably out of time, but I thought it was all very, very good and useful research, and those are some interesting further things that you might like to think about.
OK, well, thank you very much for the feedback. That's been really good. I guess, you know, a key part was, as you pointed out, that Malcolm, you pointed out, you know, the money isn't free. You pay for a lender of last resort provision. And similarly, in the actual 2008 experience in Australia, the government actually didn't need to, you know, pull out the chequebook and say, dear Bank X, here's the money that you need. And they're both taken into account. I think with regards to the actual payment of a debt guarantee, so there's two parts to that. One is you can have policies in place that aren't actually needed, and we got over the what we would call a crisis compared to some other countries where those policies were needed. Mm. And so I guess what we're doing in our paper is we're saying we're setting up a structure where in certain circumstances those policies will be needed. So I guess you could say, well, look, in some ways the actual crisis situation better models the US or Ireland or Iceland rather than modelling what actually happened here in Australia. But what we're doing is we're taking the step back and we're saying, OK, well, assuming that there is a possibility in Australia that those funds will be needed at some time, we didn't need them in 2008, thank goodness, but they may be needed in the future, what are the implications of that for banking structure and for interest rates today? So I guess that's what we're looking at there. On the payment for the guarantee, yeah, I was actually thinking about that during when I wasn't paying attention to, I apologise to one of the people, one of my fellow presenters, because that was raised during the question time, and I thought, yeah, we've got to be able to work that out. And if that is an interesting question, I think it's actually fairly easy to put into our model of having, you know, in a sense, an idea of the right payment and working out what that will do. It will still have implications on the banking structure because it will reduce the number of banks in equilibrium, it will have a competitive effect. Now, again, we may say that is the cost that we have in place to enable the banking system to cover a crisis, but we need to understand what those costs are.
Just another comment on that. The reason I raise the concept of self-fulfilling runs is because I think it helps to work against your fundamental conclusion. Your point is, if you provide any sort of government support or prospective support or guarantee, lender of last resort, I think falls into that category, you're protecting banks against risk and therefore encouraging them to take more risk and therefore potentially making a crisis more likely. But my point is that the existence of those support mechanisms also has the beneficial effect of reducing the, the likelihood of a self-fulfilling run on a bank. And
not saying these don't have benefits. Mm. And obviously, if you can have a line of credit for the banks, which stops a run on the banks, that's great. Now, if it was a zero probability that ever line of credit ever being drawn on, then there would be no implications for the banking system. Mm. We've got a positive probability that line of credit will actually be required, and that's where it feeds back in. And yes, no troubles bringing in. What if there was a limit on sovereign support? What if you went down Iceland's approach where you said, well, look, protect the domestic deposit is tough luck if you're a foreign deposit? All of that can be built into the structure.